the award-winning FatWallet show this week, tips and tricks for buying a home. Hey, I'm Christia. With me, as always, Simon Brown. How's it going?
It's good.
If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleeped version of the show is available on justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for doing that for us. So in episode 111 that went out on the 30th of July in 2018, I talk about buying a house and the process of buying a house. And I've received so many cool questions and thoughts and tips and tricks that I decided we should do an entire episode just on like discussing those, because it turns out you guys are really good at buying property. So I'm just going to dive right in. We started talking about Sally's question in a previous episode, I think about episode 113 probably. And then we couldn't get to Sally's question, which turned out to be really good, because in the time that it took us to get to Sally's question, Sally actually found an answer to her own question.
Oh, excellent.
So this is what happened. She has a second property that she's renting out. Is it letting or renting out? It's letting, right? Letting the property. But she didn't buy it initially as an investment property. She bought it to live in herself, and then her circumstances changed. Then she kept it. Then when we started talking about the property thing, it got her thinking about her own property, and she's like, should I keep it? Should I sell it? Whatever. And what I was going to say initially is, how would you think about this if it were just an ordinary investment, if it weren't a house? Like, how would things change if you take out the idea that it's a physical piece of property and it's just an investment?
It's a cow.
Just an ordinary investment.
Okay, dear Lord, not
please,
a cow.
Please stop saying cows. Guys, don't write us about cows anymore. We don't want to talk about cows.
They're so cute.
They are adorable. And you shouldn't eat them. But aside from that, I don't want to say anything.
No, they're tasty too.
So I was going to say to Sally, would it change how you think about the investment if it were just a share investment? But she then wrote back and she's like, oh, I'm so glad you didn't discuss my question. She says, I've always been of the mind that an investment in property is a good thing, and I've never really looked into it any deeper in terms of returns, etc. I was mostly covering costs, and I figured I'll have extra income once the property has been paid off, which is, it's a good way to think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like passive income. That's what we're all going for. Then she did the Stealthy Wealth spreadsheet. I'll put that in the show notes. You guys can go find that at stealthywealth.co.za. It's awesome. I used it just yesterday because I eventually made an offer on a place and used Stealthy spreadsheet to work out how long it would take before my home loan repayments, because that's what it does. It works out when your home loan repayments become less than the rent you would have paid, is making some assumptions. It's awesome. She said, I filled out all the actual money that went in and out of this property over the years, and the returns currently are sitting around 8 to 10%, which is not great. I've actually been extremely lucky with tenants, and I've had no vacancies with this place, but who knows how long that luck would last. Then I looked at the retirement number. She said she didn't even know about early retirement until she started listening to us, and now it's like a mission for her. She says, my cost of living with the income is lower, so the number I need to reach is lower, and I could potentially reach it in 15 years. So her retirement number, that's what she's talking about. Yeah. Without the income from the rental property, my retirement number is a bit higher, but without the property, I would have more disposable income, obviously, because she's not paying the bond.
Mm-hmm.
She was saying in a previous email that it costs her about 1,000 rand a month to run the property. So she's not making like a huge profit from it. She says, if I'm disciplined, I could actually reach the higher number in just under 14 years. So she would actually reach her retirement amount earlier, a year earlier. Due to the amount of money in and out of the bond, the amount of cash from the sale will not be huge. But on the plus side, I won't have a bond to pay off anymore. I'm thinking I may now put it on the market and buy some nice passive property ETFs. I'm in no rush to sell, so that's in my favor. I understand that it may take time, which isn't an issue either. What do you think? Have I missed anything critical? Or do you have any further arguments for keeping versus selling?
No, hey, spreadsheets for the win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we met somebody the other day who has a bunch of investment properties who says he gets like 15% rental yield from those properties. But they're all bonded. And this is the something that Cheapo and I were talking about on Twitter is So I've now finally made an offer on a place. I'm waiting for that to go through. And with that offer, I actually have a negative net worth. My liabilities outstrip my assets. But now, how do you think about the actual physical property?
Well, no. So you buy the property and you pay R1 million for it. So that then becomes an asset. And now you take out R1 million bond. Well, truthfully, probably a R900,000 bond. And that then is a liability. So they, in essence, they should equal each other out.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't I just count the assets, like the part of the bond that I've paid off?
No, because they're two different moving parts. The property value will go up and down over the time, and the amount owed will go down over time. So they sit each individually on your balance sheet. One is an asset, one is a liability.
So I referred Sally to the buy versus let presentation that Magnus DeVette did for us a while back. There he runs the number. He literally compares passive property investments, not ETFs necessarily, just.
See, he did the benchmark. Companies. Yeah, he did the benchmark, the index, which essentially you could replicate with an ETF.
Yeah. So property companies versus buy to let property, and he's like, in the end, you come out slightly better with the share investment.
Yeah.
And it's also just a hell of a lot less effort. So Christian shared a bond calculator with us, which I'll include in the show notes. It is amazing. It shows how your monthly contribution would change if the interest rate changes, which is super useful. It shows how many times you'll be paying the property if you just paid the bond amount. So in my case, I would pay the property off 2.36 times if I just paid the minimum bond amount. Isn't that unreal?
That banks, eh? I mean, that's why they have those big buildings in Rosebank and Sandton. And
so if I pay it off the way that I want to pay it off, I would pay it off just over once. So,
Yeah. Good old-fashioned way.
Oh, my goodness, it's unreal. The spreadsheet also shows how additional payments would affect your payment term. So if you planned an additional payment, my additional payment would shave 14 years off my bond repayment. So I would basically pay mine off in 6 years.
Because it's the three tricks, right? The one is to pay more than you need to, ideally at least 10% more. So if your bond is 8K, pay 8.8. The second is every year when you get a salary increase, increase that 8.8 by the salary increase you got. And then also pay on salary date rather than on the first, because those few extra days can shave 14 months off your bond repayment period.
I'm definitely also going to do what Stealthy Wealth does, which is use my bond account to keep my emergency fund, keep my tax savings, all of that stuff.
Check on your status of access bond, etc., because I've heard some horror stories.
So this is not exactly an access bond, because an access bond implies that you could borrow money on your bond again. That's actually what an access bond is. This is called something else. I forget what it is.
As long as you can get the money. I know someone who kept her savings in her bond and then went to get them and the bank was like, no.
Yeah, they are actually allowed. It says in the terms and conditions they can change the rules on you.
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
That's why God made terms and conditions.
So then I got some emails from people who are like, do not buy a property. Antoine and Cheapo were very much team rent. Antoine says, the emotional temptation of owning your property is that it gives you control to fix broken things. However, it's not easy to deal with contractors. Although I do a lot of these things myself, I don't have time and it doesn't make financial sense to spend time on these things. So in a sense, I have to rely and deal with the quality of someone else's work. And I have to say, Antoine, I have to agree with you, because over the past, 6 months or so, I've just had terrible experiences with people providing services. I don't know if I'm just really sensitive or if people are just really bad at their jobs.
People
I don't know
are immensely
what is going on.
Bad. I mean, over the years when I've had contractors, and I think I had one chap who I would rate highly, and at
is
least
that your
half,
fan man?
Oh, two chaps. The rest of them rated poor.
Yeah.
And some of them like really, really poor. And some didn't even finish the job. They were it up so badly they just left.
Man, I used a company called Device Doctor to fix my phone the other day. I cannot believe how terrible the service was. They had my phone for a month. Like they had to fix one thing. They had my phone for a month, and they had to fix one thing and replace the battery. Nobody phoned me in that time. to tell me what is going on, how long it's going to take, when they're going to get back to me, what it's going to cost. Nothing, not a word. So every interaction I had with them was me phoning them going, is it ready? Is it ready? Is it ready? Then when they finally deliver the phone, it comes back and they didn't replace the battery that I had paid for and that they had my phone for a month. Then I had to take it back to them. Then they kept delivering it to the wrong place. I was like, oh my word, could I just never ever have to deal with you again? It was so terrible. Yeah. And the same with when I had to have my fiber installed, and the same, you know, it's just been like the one thing after the other for me this year. It was awful. Anyway, so Antoine says, I own the property we live in. My wife owns the property next to us where my in-laws stay, and my dad just bought the property opposite us. Man, that sounds nice. It's like a little community of Antoine's.
Sure. If you like your community.
He says, this takes a whole lot of choices away from us. Although I can decide when to fix things, it'll be nearly impossible for us to move if I suddenly get a better opportunity elsewhere. Before you buy, reframe the problem and think about all the choices you have if you want to move to a different location or province at the drop of a hat. It might help alleviate, I suppose, the emotional anxiety. Then decide to buy a house because it makes rational financial sense, or decide to just rent a different apartment. If you have a lot of time on your hands to fix things at the house yourself and you actually enjoy doing stuff like this, you should do that. Buying and renovating might be reframed as a second job. I get that. And somebody else also sent an email to talk about like the actual financial impact of buying. His name is Radebeger Lassie von Tigerbaum, and I'm really starting to regret letting people choose their own pseudonyms.
But I want to go back to that location thing. That's perfectly correct. I mean, if I decide I want to live in Durban next year, and you, like, now what?
Well, then you rent out the place because somebody else wrote about
you're a landlord and you got yeah. to, I hear you. But like,
somebody else wrote about selling a property before 8 years passes. And they were saying that it just doesn't make sense because of all the duties and lawyers' fees and stuff that you have to pay. It takes 8 years for you to break even. So from what I understood, it's 8 years to break even with what you would have paid in rent over a similar period.
Yeah, gotcha.
I can't sell now for a decade, which is terrifying to me because I've never committed to anything for a decade. That's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time. So Radebeger said, I'm on a bit of a present value mission right now. One calculation you owe yourself is to consider what the extra money costs, what the extra monthly costs of a house are worth by retirement when adding in compound growth. So that's the real cost. So he's talking here about levies and maintenance and all of that stuff. So
but that's also a good point, is that when we hit retirement, typically the house that we're in is probably not the house that we're going to retire into. If nothing else, kids and stuff like that. So at some point into the future, we're almost a forced seller, or, I mean, there's some deal we've got to start to make there.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that you buy a house and it's an asset and you die with it. I mean, my grandparents did it. Did they own their house? I think they did. But it's truthfully not that massively viable. And they lived in comparatively large house for the two of them. It's just too big.
So Radebeger says, at least if you buy it, you know beforehand what the actual future value is, rather than screaming into the night later, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
Then Cheapo and I had a conversation about what a bond does to your overall net worth, which we spoke about earlier. So both of us will have more liabilities than assets due to our home loans. Then we also spoke about, so the Outvest app has this wedding planner thing, because do you remember Dr. Woof wrote us about getting married?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been using that story to go through the kind of to write different elements that he should consider. And I use the Outvest wedding calculator thing, which is awesome. So you select whether you want a silver, gold, or platinum wedding. And obviously you choose the platinum wedding, right? Because...
Not a fact. You choose the do they have copper?
But what's so cool about that is you say, this is the kind of wedding you want. This is the style of wedding you want. In other words, you want all the bells and whistles. And then you go through that Outvest process, and then it spits out a comprehensive budget, basically, of every single thing you would ever need to get for a wedding. And you can adjust those figures yourself. So if you want to pay for your bridesmaids' dresses, for example, you can adjust those figures, et cetera, et cetera. But what was astounding to me is I chose the platinum option. It doesn't include the price of the rings, which is what Dr. Woof was worried about. So you can add about like another 50,000 rand on top of this. But I got to 300,000 rand for platinum wedding, for like all bells and whistles wedding.
Mm.
And then Chipo was saying, it took her an embarrassingly long time to have that in her retirement savings. Like, she worked for many, many years to have that in her retirement savings. And I was like, yeah, same. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, that's not a, it's ridiculous. Anyway, so she says, I listened to the Fat Wallet podcast and I couldn't believe you were even considering liquidating your tax-free account. I kept screaming, no, Christia, don't do it to myself.
I'm with her. Yes, yeah. Yes.
I had to ask, though.
Okay. Yeah, asked. Answered.
So Cliff has his financial situation completely under control and he wants to know what percentage of his portfolio should go towards buying a home. He says, I'm invested in and contribute monthly to ETFs, equities, both domestic and abroad, tax-free savings, and an RA. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Not many people can say that. He says, I've even dabbled in some cryptos. I also have about 25% of his overall net worth in cash, which I have in a money market account that I can draw from if I see a good buying opportunity that I like. Awesome. He says, when the day comes where I want to buy an apartment or house, what percentage of my portfolio should I contribute towards buying a house? I wouldn't want to sell any of my equity holdings, and I would prefer to buy in full with cash. That would be amazing if you could do that. I mean, that's obviously the way to go, like if you can. But that would also not be a wise decision because I would be putting all my eggs in one basket. Well, you would be putting 25% of your eggs in one basket in this case. He says, when it comes to buying, would you recommend contributing 50% of my portfolio towards the purchase of the house and mortgaging the other 50% or putting down the minimum 10%, pay a larger monthly mortgage and have less disposable income to invest in the market every month? I live in Cape Town. Where the price of it,
mooch. He can't afford anything.
Where the price of a two-bedroom apartment is around 2 million. Like, just to contextualize that for you, I've been looking at two-bedroom apartments in Joburg area, so like outlying, not fancy Joburg, but outlying Joburg, and you can get a fairly large two-bedroom apartment for somewhere between 700 and 1 million in Joburg. I'm also considering what Simon said, that cash is king when buying property. So I also want to refer you guys to Stealthy Wealth wrote an article once about the cost of living in Cape Town. So he basically compared wages, like average mm-hmm. wages in Cape Town to average house prices. And he wrote an article called Living in Cape Town, The Definition of Stupidity. So I wonder where he'll come out on that.
And then you have winter and no water. So I think there's two good points here. So the first is traditionally people approach the perspective from how much of my salary should go to bond repayment or something like that. And the banks will look at as much as 30%, which I think is...
That is dumb.
Frantically far too high. I think it should be closer to 10. Maybe you want to push it to 15. And but that's really from the bank saying how much you can afford. And truth is, take the number down. But I'll, 10, 15, 5. I mean, it's to the point of so the bank says we'll give you a million. Nice, but go buy something for 600. Typically the bank says I'll give you a million. So you find something for 1.2 million and you just, it just goes out of control. But the interesting part of the question there as well is what percentage of your portfolio? Now, we were a moment ago, your property goes on the asset side of your balance sheet. I hear you, debt, everything else, etc. But how much of your investment portfolio, we're now calling a property you live in an investment, it's not, but it still is a asset of sort. And the truth is that initially it's going to be giant. I mean, you can, as a 30-year-old, buy a million rand house and you might have a million rand investments, which means that it's going to be half of your investments. To the question, I would pay... So, I mean, I've paid for my apartment and the math on that is poor. I probably shouldn't have because, get the bond and leverage that and all the rest, etc. I just didn't... I was trying to cut my costs as low as possible. Hence, I paid for it. What it does mean is the money that I would normally put into the bond every month, say 10,000 a month that should go into the bond, I can then use for other investments or holidays, but in truth, put them somewhere else. So I would favor larger deposit but I wouldn't sell equity to fund the deposit. If you got that 25% cash pile, use that for your deposit and rather buy down on the purchase price to make that a more significant deposit.
Look, I think that should be a way to go anyway. Like, whatever it is that you're looking at, and I know how much this sucks because having just gone through this process, like I saw what I could afford and how nice the places is that the bank would have happily approved me for. And then I saw in the range that I was actually buying at, and they really are just not as nice, and it's really difficult to do. But if you can, I mean, this is what like every piece of financial advice that we ever give on this show comes down to: keep your lifestyle expenses as low as possible.
Yeah, and that money, you know, so now you've got some extra cash, so your apartment's maybe less lacquer, but you can go buy a lacquer couch instead, or stuff like that. But it gives you, the point is that lifestyle creep where our monthly expenses just get so giant, and that puts us at risk as well. Hey, so if we are living in the edge of our expenses, and you lose a job, or you interest rates go suddenly spike 50%, you know, from what the current 10 to 15 or something like that, you're now vulnerable. You're vulnerable to the whole house of cards coming down.
I heard a horror story this week about somebody who got a new job. So it's a couple, and one of the people in the couple got a new job and a giant raise, and then bought a house, and 3 weeks after signing the papers for the house, she lost her job. And they have just lost everything. They've lost that because they went balls to the wall, the absolute most expensive, luxurious property they could afford, and then they couldn't afford it anymore.
Yeah.
And this is why we always talk about emergency funds. This is why we talk about keeping your cost of living low, because we don't always have control over what happens to us. Like, sometimes companies fail and we lose our jobs, and, you know, it's not our own fault, but you have to be able to sustain yourself.
And whilst we show lots of loyalty to the companies we work for, they show zero loyalty back to us. I was at Standard Bank when we did the retrenchment program in 2010, and there's no loyalty, you know, and there I know that, and the one woman in particular, she'd got an increase. She'd bought a fancy BMW, and I suppose 5 months, 6 months later, she was retrenched.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm going to lose the car. And Standard Bank's like, yeah.
Yeah. Look, yeah. So, like, I suppose also over time, Cliff, as Simon was saying, as your bond becomes smaller, obviously it would become a smaller part of your liabilities, while you would still keep the asset. So, and then hopefully over time you can reduce your cost of living, which, as Stealthy pointed out, and this is not something that I'd ever thought about, but if you've got a paid off property, the amount of money you need to retire is much lower because you're not paying rent now, you're just paying levies. So for me, that would, like, the amount of money that I would need in retirement once my place is paid off would probably go down by 5,000 rand, which is a significant saving.
Yeah. I mean, I've quoted this number before. From going from a large house, et cetera, to where I am now, and the house was bonded and the flat is paid off, my cost of home has dropped 85% a month.
Yeah.
85%. I mean, it's just suddenly you are awash with cash flow. It's like, you know, it is humongous.
But, and I think, Cliff, you already know this probably, but you would just have to pay this off as soon as possible.
Yeah.
But don't sell equity to do this. Somebody else pointed out, and I don't know, like, I've spoken to so many people about this because, so I don't know who said this, but they were saying, instead of putting down a deposit, take the full amount, take 100% bond, and then put the deposit in your bond as cash flow.
Yeah, so two things. The banks, I'm not sure they do 100% bonds anymore. The person who tried to buy my place was looking for 100% bond and just got nowhere with it. And hence I was able to sneak it and buy it from them, before them. I'm not thrilled with that idea, because here's the thing. So basically you're fudging money. So you're saying, here's my 100,000 rand deposit. It's also my 100,000 rand emergency fund. And you're now using that money twice, in a sense. I think it needs to be, here's my 100,000 emergency fund and 100,000 deposit. Look, and they separate 100,000s. And if you don't have the separate 100,000s, buy down.
That makes sense to me to do it that way, because for me to put a deposit on this place, I would have to obliterate my emergency fund and start over, which just makes me feel very unsafe because I'm moving into a new place, which is obviously You know, like a million things can go wrong when you move into a new place.
So and you need curtains and couches. And
the thing is also then you reduce your principal amount, because I know the argument is that you pay so much interest. But you reduce your principal amount by whatever you pay and above your That's right, right? Everything you pay over and above what the bank asks you goes towards your principal, not towards the interest. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. And if you put 100,000 in, what it means is, so say you put 100,000 in and the bank actually wants 10,000 a month from you. Truthfully, they only want 9, because that 100,000 is reducing the liability amount, and therefore you come out, you're overpaying. So that money you put in there is essentially overpayment. And the point with it is you're getting a tax-free return of whatever your interest rate is. So if you're at 10 or 11%, you're getting a tax-free return of 10 or 11%.
So that made sense to me. I think I'm considering going that route, but I'll see. I haven't decided yet. So Get Down Adam who is, and this is actually I call him Get Down Adam because that's actually his email address.
Oh, okay.
It's not a pseudonym that he chose. That is just, it's just really funny. And I was like, oh, you've got such a great email address. And he's like, yo, it's all fun and games, but he's a doctor. And he's like, it's all fun and games until you have to discuss like a real medical emergency with somebody and they like can't stop laughing at your email address. Anyway, so he is a doctor and apparently he says he's a late bloomer. But we live much longer. So finding your career later in life is probably the better way to go, Adam. I don't think late bloomer is a thing anymore. So he wants to know about buy-to-let property. He says, I come from a family where money wasn't discussed and property is king. From what you say on the podcast, property is a less smart investment these days, and I get that, but I also hate paying rent, even if the maths makes sense. I'm having trouble shaking the emotional connection to property. I have my eye on a piece of land that could potentially fit 3 small townhouses. No one else is built there because there's an issue with access, but the land borders my parents' property and they would sell me the access. The issue is that the land is overvalued for something you can't use. The seller doesn't know that I could potentially use it, so I could get a deal, maybe. I could theoretically build 3, let 2, and live in 1. Is this a dangerous game? I know property itself is a nightmare, but there's a big part of me telling me this is a sneaky opportunity. He also has a second question related to property that we'll look, or unrelated to property that we'll look at in a future episode.
So the answer is yes. This is a dangerous game.
It is a dangerous game, but also it's an opportunity, you know, like.
Okay, so let's discuss 2 things. But the access point is, make sure it is codified and legal, i.e. either in the title deed to your parents' place you have servitude, or that they physically sell you the land and you carve it up. And that's both of those are going to cost you money. Both of those are going to incur lawyers and counselors and everything. And the reason why I say it, because one day your parents sell their house to someone and they're like, no, you can't drive down here. You've got to put it in law for one day when your parents don't have the house. That's going to cost you money. The idea of having a property and then putting 3 on and selling 2, or renting 2 and living on 1, or renting 3 or selling 3 or something, is deeply fun. And I know a number of people who've tried it, and I know 0 people who've actually at the end of the day come out ahead. And I remember having an interview, a conversation with Baldwin. They listed, they do those giant estates, 500,000, 2,000, 3,000. And he started like it. And his key comment was, he says, it's just about scale. And when you're trying to do it small, you don't have scale. You don't have the skills. You don't have the knowledge. You know, Baldwin will get there, whatever they need, X, Y, or Z, at fractions of the price that you will, because they buy in bulk, because they've been doing it for 30 years. Property development is a skill. It's like being a Formula One racing driver or a trapeze, whatever. I mean, it's a skill. And with respect, we're probably going to mess it up. I mean, you know, the numbers on paper look great, but they never come out on paper. I mean, you go to an architect and you ask them to, a QS gives you a price to build a house. And you notice there's always a thing at the bottom which says, oh, 10% contingency. You'll also notice if you watch the TV shows around people who build houses, they're never within 20% of their budget.
Okay, so let's talk about the maths of this, because so there's this report that ABSA does that talks about the average price per square meter of new properties, mm-hmm. and they divided into freestanding houses and flats and apartments, et cetera, et cetera. And the cost per square for an apartment, and now remember, this is an average across the country, which means, Adam, if you are based in Joburg, it's going to be much higher. But if you're based in like Wakkerstroom, it's probably going to be a bit lower. But they use the cost per, or they indicate cost per square for townhouses at around 8,000, just over 8,000 rand. All right. So you have to think about that just for the building cost. Then, as Simon mentioned, the cost of the legalities and the zoning, because I know that sectional titles also have some complexities around yeah. how they managed and how they zoned and where you can build and what you can do. And then the cost of managing the properties, because you would probably have to pay an estate agent to manage the rentals for you, draw up the contract.
So if you're going to rent them or if you're going to sell them, you've got to pay an agent to sell them. You've also got to pay for landscaping. You know, you've got to put turf down and make a pretty garden and all of that sort of stuff.
And maintenance. So if you work on maintenance, they normally say if you buy a house, you should work on maintenance of 1 to 2% per year of the cost of purchase. Mm-hmm. If you have this, your maintenance would be much higher because you would be... So there would obviously be levies to take care of the outside of the buildings. But for the for some of the more general stuff, you would be liable for that sort of thing. So 1 to 2% of the value of all of that.
You also need a project manager, which may or may not be in the 8,000. So what you can...
Ooh, and an architect.
And an architect. And you could buy plans off the interwebs and you could project manage it yourself. Don't, but unless this is... But
look, he is a doctor, so I don't think he's going to have time to be able to yeah. do that.
But, I mean, and there is one potential with the cost overrun of the 8,000 a square meter is that some builders will do you a fixed cost. In other words, you agree and they say this is what it will cost regardless, assuming you don't change what you want. But oftentimes you do. Something on paper, and then you come to build it, and it's like, that looked good on paper, but doesn't work in practicality, so... That wall we have built, can you tear it down and move it 3 feet and et cetera? I mean, are there people who have made money doing this? Sure. I've never met them. And I, off the top of my head, can think of five people over the last 20 years who've tried this one way or another. And all of them, at best, break even. Most of them lost money on it.
Yeah, right. It is a skill. On the other hand, like the thing is, I don't want to... Because you guys know how we feel about buy-to-let property. We keep referring you to that Magnus de Wet thing, which is mm-hmm. like, you know, but maybe you're not lazy like we are. Like, we just don't want to project manage huge things in general in life at all, ever.
More costs. Is it serviced? Does it have power and water?
Ooh,
and
rates
stuff?
And taxes. Is there any outstanding rates and taxes? Because this is something I also learned. The person who owned the property that I just made an offer on bought it on auction. And he didn't know, and neither did I, that if you buy something on auction, you are liable for all the outstanding taxes and levies on those properties. So make sure that you're also not, because it seems like this piece of property has been not used for a long time. So make sure that there's no outstanding levies yeah. and stuff there but that you might be liable
for. Is that not only an auction issue?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, just flag yeah. that as a potential issue because you don't know.
Yeah, and then you might need to get City Power or whoever to come and bring you power, and you might need to get
water,
sanitation, and all of that. And
yeah, how much does that cost?
I have no idea. Well, so I know that the chappy, and I forget his name now, the previous editor of Business Day, it was going to cost 200,000 to get power to his house in the Karoo. So he just went solar because that also cost him 200,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes way more sense. Yeah.
So when you drive through the Karoo, you notice all the houses are close to the road because if you build the house far from the road, Eskom's like, you want power, you pay.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right. Then Not Get Down Adam also wrote us. So I was worried about inspecting a home before you buy it. Then he shared this really, really awesome service that does it. And I got that email about an hour after I signed my offer to purchase, which is a really big bummer. And I really, really hope this works out for me because now it's like I don't know.
Like too late.
Yeah. He says, on your podcast, you made mention about checking cracks, mold, damp, etc. before buying a place. My personal experience has been to enlist the professionals here, like Inspect Our Home.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll share that link in the show notes. I've used these guys twice for both my places. And I actually had their investigation as part of the subject to criteria before purchasing. And this, I would have loved to be able to do this if I had only checked my email an hour earlier. They do a full inspection and will identify faulty wiring, mold, cracks, with a neat little report that really helps. So obviously this is a service that you pay for. It's not free.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a really, really, really great
service. And you know, there's a couple of issues. They're always going to come back and find faults. No place is perfect. I mean, a brand new built place is probably going to have some issues with it. So don't be put off by that. And don't be put off by the cost, because, you know, there might be a slash of paint and you don't see the mold. And that's a real issue. They're going to find it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is real and hugely important. When we bought our house, the wiring was so bad. I mean, the seller obviously bribed an electrician to sign off a certificate. The wiring was so bad that it actually caught a light once. Fortunately, there was an electrician on site fixing the problem. Otherwise, our house would have burnt down.
Mm.
And we didn't do an inspector thingy-majiggy. And that person would have come back and said, this wiring is balked.
Okay, so I just want to end off with where I am now in my process, because lots of people have been asking. And Sally and I have actually been like exchanging emails for weeks about this.
It's been
super fun.
Notwithstanding, we are time traveling.
We are time traveling. Okay, so today is August 16th.
Yes.
Oh, nailed it. Do you know that today is also the day we do the Zach One Lap Index, and it is exactly 1 year since we created the Listener Love Index. So happy birthday to the Listener Love Index.
Okay. They're about to kill you.
So I've made an offer on a place. It's been 2 weeks since I made my initial offer, and the owner still hasn't signed any paperwork. And so I've now kind of gotten to a point where I've said to the estate agent, look, if there's no signed paperwork by close of business today, then the deal's off and I'm just going to look for something else. Because either the owner or the estate agent is not being...
Yeah.
Serious about this situation. And I think they're both holding out for a better price. I ended up negotiating a 10% discount almost exactly on the asking price. No, a little bit more than a 10% discount on the asking price. But it's still a little bit more expensive than I would have liked to pay by 20,000 rand. Which is okay. It's like I had that money saved up anyway. So, and I'm, so pending, I suppose.
Bending.
Like I've made an offer. It was terrifying. It was exhilarating. It's been fun. It's been awful. But I still don't actually have a house.
No, it's an alarmingly slow process.
How long did it take you before the owner signed your offer?
We gave him 24 hours.
So I also gave him 24 hours, but the agent keeps going, oh, I can't get hold of the guy today.
No, to me, that's absolute bollocks. As far as I'm concerned, that offer has expired and is no longer valid.
Yeah.
So remember what we did was there was an accepted offer was on the property, but subject to 100% bond. So we snuck in and made a cash offer.
Mm.
And then the person who was doing the bond had 24 hours to match that offer, i.e. get their bond or find cash. And they didn't. It lapsed when we got it. It was 24 hours. When you bought the other place, we put the offer in and we gave them 72 hours to accept it. We haggled on price and we had a signed returned offer within 72 hours.
Yeah. So if it's not, I would be very sad to lose this place because I really like it. But if it's not done by today, like I just feel like if you're making a deal worth hundreds of thousands of rands.
Make yourself available.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's it from the Just One Lap team this week. Please remember that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. My name is Chris Stephanie Yedden. Thank you so much to Simon Brown. We'll catch you again next week.